Welcome back to another episode of the Placeholders Podcast. I'm Kaylee Fretz. It's Monday, February 6th. We've got some big news for you. You might have caught our special episode that dropped end of last week, which means that Dave Rome's presence on this podcast is nearing its bitter, bitter end. Just for today, I should say.
I'm not bitter about it.
No, you looked at the run sheet. You're like, I'm out. I'm going to talk to you again on Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got a dedicated pod for those that care about tech. We'll have a place for you to go to and still hear my voice from and hear Kaylee from and hear a third voice who a lot of people have guessed who that is, but we'll be able to confirm that in a few days. And yeah, I'm excited to just talk tech and not have to pretend to talk racing as well. So it's good for everyone involved, including you, the listener.
I would say you've done an admirable job, Dave, pushing through, talking bike racing. I mean, the first couple of episodes were just you, me, and Dane.
Yep.
And we got through those just fine.
Yep.
Well done.
Thanks to Cav as well.
Mostly
wouldn't
thanks
have
to
had
Cav.
Anything else to talk about otherwise. So.
Well, before we get into the rest of things, just so everybody else knows, if you did miss the episode last week, so we're going to call this thing Geek Warning. We came up with about 1,000 names in a WhatsApp group and decided we didn't like any of them and that we should just go right back to where we started, and we're going to call it Geek Warning, and that will be available on its own channel end of this week, probably Thursday. Will also be on the channel you are listening to right now. So if you don't want to do anything, if you want to listen to both podcasts, all you got to do is stay subscribed, keep listening right here. It'll pop up on Thursday. So with that, Dave Rome.
Yeah.
It's been good, man.
It's been real.
I'll talk to you in
officially,
2 days.
I'm the first placeholder of the placeholders, and that job is now complete. So off I go, and good luck to the rest of you. Yeah, thank you. All right, I'm signing off. Good to see you all.
See you, Dave.
I'll see you again. Cheers.
Well, obviously, it's not just me and Dave on this podcast. We've got a pretty great crew for you today. Dan Cash, welcome back.
Hello. How we doing?
I'm great. I'm doing really good. Ian Trellor, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And special guest this week, somebody we've mentioned offhand a couple different times. I keep getting tagged in Twitter things along with you. Cosmo Catalano, how are you this evening?
I am well, Kaylee, and I am ready to disagree with you.
I can't wait. This is what this podcast has needed, is somebody with the gall to just call me an idiot to my face as opposed to doing it on the internet later on.
I just said disagree.
are we disagreeing about anything in particular, or is it just like a blanket anti-Kaylee?
Most things. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Yep,
I can get on board with that.
All right, let's talk about what we're going to talk about. So we've got a whole bunch of things for you today. We're going to talk about Patrick Lefebvre's pillows. That's a big one. We're going to talk Crossworlds. In fact, that's a big part of the reason why we've got Cosmo on this episode. We're going to talk about Esteban Chavez and his tears on the podium. Talk about Alexander Kristoff's Craigslist ad. We're going to kick off a new segment, which I don't know if it will be recurring or not, but I'm hoping it will be, where we spot some talent. We'll call it talent spotting, perhaps. We're going to hear from freelance writer Chris Marshall Bell and on Thomas Gloag, who surprised Pro Peloton over the weekend in one of his, first real stage race, I think. Do a bit of Nielsen Palace, do a bit of Rui Costa, and something about Sarsaparilla. Or possibly Fanta at the end of today's show. Unclear exactly where we're going to go with that one. I think the place to start, though, and then I think doing anything else would be an injustice, is we got to start with Crossworlds. We really do. So now, normally I would go to Dane and say, Dane, what happened over the weekend? Dane, are you comfortable answering that question, or should I go straight to Cosmo on this
one? I'm comfortable answering that question with the sort of obvious note that I did also text Cosmo so that he could also answer that question. So he may be better suited to answer the question. I think you should just throw right to him. He's got the expertise.
Honestly, I'm surprised that you two cyclocross dislikers are letting the show lead, even with the sports biggest stage, and let me tell you, the Dutch know how to put on a bike race. Like, that was a sensational spectacle, even if you dismiss the women's elite race as a time trial, which, Kaylee, makes me think you maybe tuned in late. I know it can be tough to get up mountain time, but no, it was it was a great show.
Well, let's kick off with the women's race. It was early. It was early in the morning. I have a 2-year-old, and also I was solo with said 2-year-old this weekend. My wife was out of town, and so things were chaotic. So I missed about half the race. So if you could fill me in on the first 25 minutes or so. I've got the last bit, but fill me in on the first bit, and then we can talk about how it wrapped up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it really came. The race before the race was pretty decisive, considering they line up by points. Puck Pietersa was, you can kind of see footage of the start. She's lined up, and they all lined up in a line, right? They have a piece of tape across, and as soon as they move the tape away, everyone starts creeping forward. Puck Pietersa, who is really one of the pre-race favorites, just didn't seem to get the memo on creeping, and then they started the race, and she completely missed her pedal, basically instantly demoted herself to fourth row. Yeah, it was. You should ask Maglie Rochette about it. She talked about it in her post race interview. But she was like, "Oh, I'll line up behind, you know, Pietersa, it'll be perfect." And the next thing she knows, she's trying not to crash over her rear wheel as she, you know, scoots back. And
as a rider, because like I do that at stoplights all the time. So I guess ostensibly the second best cross racer on the planet. It did humanize things a little bit, you know.
Sure. I mean, it happens to everybody. And you know, for every Puck Pietersa start, there's a Femme Van Empel start, cuz she was just so dialed. You know, right off the gun, didn't quite take the whole shot, but was in second and almost immediately elbowed her way to the front and really just lined things out and then made a big attack. There's really, as great a spectacle as it was, the course was not, I think the women's elite race had the best conditions in terms of creating a good race, but there really was just this one long drag power climb where the strongest riders separated themselves. And in Van Empel's case, it was her on the first lap. Pietersa eventually recovered from her start and fought her way through the scrum and got back and kind of pulled even with her, tried to do that, you know, Puck Pietersa mountain biking style of riding, really put pressure on her. And Van Empel was just completely unmoved. Like, you know, you could almost see like the red Terminator eye as she just kept grinding and grinding. And you know, this is
what cyclocross passion sounds like, everybody. I'm just very much enjoying this so far.
even if you didn't love the racing, the scenery and the drone shots they had chasing these racers through the woods were just beautiful. Like what we should have been seeing in bike racing for the past half decade at least. And it's just,
I want to return to the drone shots. So keep the drone shots in mind, because was actually, as a cyclocross what's the opposite of aficionado,
casual,
you're not the opposite of an aficionado. Like, you have raced cyclocross before, you watch a lot
I've raced national championships. I got hip checked by Ryan Trebone one time. That was an exciting moment.
So you're just
life.
A cyclocross follower. You're a guy who watches some cyclocross.
Yeah. That's all I am. Anyway, as one of them, the drone shots were the highlight of the weekend for me. So we are going to come back to that. But Cosmo, continue. How do we wrap up here?
Van Empel, you know, like, she kept the pressure on. There was one bobble from Pietersa, and she slid out, and, you know, I think she just burned so many matches getting back into the fight that she was pretty spent by that point. It took her about half a lap to even get back into second place. And Van Empel, in her post-race interview, was very much like, Pietersa crashed, and I went full gas, and that was the end of it. And she, you know, it wasn't like it was easy. She still rode the course, you know, as hard as she could, eking out seconds. She had a really strong lap where I think she gained about 18 seconds and then sort of eased off a bit, but, like, just a beautiful, perfect ride. Pietersa, I think, was a little disappointed, but still came in with a wheelie, which she had promised to do in her pre-ride. She does these pre-ride videos that go on YouTube, and she's like, if I win, I'll do a wheelie. She still did the wheelie, which was cool to see. I think the only person who wheelied in. It was a solid ride, and I thought, like I said, the conditions were slippery. I don't think we got that in the men's race. I think the men's race, you know, was almost like a road race in the sense that 95% of the time, you kind of knew how it was going to end.
Well, and what's amazing to me is that despite the fact that the conditions were about as sort of nice as you can get in a cross race, which in theory makes it sort of easier to everything to kind of hold together, right? We still end up with these two riders who are just so much better than everybody else. They stamp their feet down lap one and extended yep. that gap. And we're basically gone. And even though they were kind of dicking around for a couple laps in the middle there,
they
still were gone, right? Like,
there. Yeah.
Like that, like they're, you know, they're, like the group behind would go from 25 seconds to 15. And then Vanderpool and Wout van Aert would be like, all right, well, I guess we should probably ride hard again. And they'd extend it back out again. Yep. And they're on a completely different level. And again, as somebody who doesn't follow cross as closely as I do other elements of the sport, for me, that rivalry is just completely untouchable right now because it does extend across multiple disciplines. It extends into cross where it almost feels at its purest, which I guess makes perfect sense considering these two have been. What was that photo that was floating around social media yesterday of like the two of them in the same jerseys? Yep. Looking really with Wout van Aert looking super grumpy and Vanderpool looking kind of happy when they were like 14 or something like that from the Sporza set. So they've been at this a very, very long time, and man, they put on a pretty incredible show on Sunday.
Yeah, and I mean, but it was like this every week almost for 2 months. The two best riders, kind of in male riders in the sport of cycling, with cameo appearances from arguably the third best, happens to be the Olympic mountain bike champion and most recent winner of road cycling's most prestigious climb, all hanging out together at the front of the race, taking shots at each other every time. You know, if we had three of them together at the front of the Classic, we'd be saying that was the race of the year. And this was, you know, over the Christmas period, they had five races in 7 days where they did this. It's just a great show.
Did you see the sprint playing out as it did?
I
guess we should maybe explain how the sprint played out. Everybody missed it.
Yeah, Vanderpool and Van Aert are off the front, like you said, clearly better than everyone else. There's a set of barriers kind of close-ish to the end, and then a steep downhill and a set of stairs, and then a kind of tricky downhill corner onto the pavement. Vanderpool has a very clear, if not substantial, advantage over Van Aert when it comes to hopping barriers. He's noticeably smoother. You know, it's not three or four bike lengths, but it's definitely a couple of pedal strokes. And I think everyone was kind of waiting for the attack to come on the barriers, because even throughout the race, he was always kind of first into the barriers, always kind of led through this technical section. And the last lap, Van Aert got in front and held the front through the barriers, held the front through this descent. And it was the first time the entire race that Van Aert had led Vanderpool through this section. And the last downhill, the last second to last corner of the race, they're kind of setting up for that last bend onto the pavement. And if you've seen the video, it's pretty tricky. You know, you're doing a 180 downhill, pretty steep off camber from dirt onto wet-ish pavement, which is really tricky to do if you've never done it on a, you know, 22 PSI knobby tubular. And right at the top of this, setting up for this corner, Vanderpool kind of comes off a little bit early, like almost looks like he's going to crash, which he has done at least twice during the course of the cross season, just kind of blowing it for no apparent reason, recovered and got onto the sprint. And I think Van Aert really made an error in not just driving it from the bottom of the hill. It's always tough to lead out a sprint, but it's a long uphill drag. And what he did was he got to the bottom and he kind of looked back. And I think that was a huge mistake, because Vanderpool, I think he is the better rider when it comes from going to 0 to 60. I think in a situation like a group sprint, Van Aert is going to be better. You come in faster. There's a lot more speed, a lot less acceleration, a lot more like holding that raw power. And, you know, Vanderpool made a big acceleration, came by, and there was just, you know, Van Aert could hold the wheel, but that was about it. And I think that was almost intentional on Vanderpool's part, kind of holding the front and driving that technical section all day, and then putting Van Aert in a situation where he'd never been the entire day and taking full advantage of where his strengths lie.
I guess a really good point about the acceleration, because if you were to put both of them together in a field sprint at the Tour de France, for instance, we've seen Van Aert win those multiple times, and we haven't really seen Vanderpool winning big field sprints nearly as often as we've seen Van Aert do it. Not to say that he's not fast, but just to point out that it's a different kind of sprint entirely. And when it's two riders kind of looking at each other and waiting for the other to go, it really is more of that kind of proverbial 0 to 60. And that's a kind of a different skill set. I also think Wout van Aert, I think he just, I don't know if he hesitated or if he just missed it. There seemed to be like just a nanosecond too late in his response to mm-hmm. Vanderpool kicking into gear. And they were so closely matched that I think that was too much for him to overcome.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he maybe kind of... Yeah. I mean, I think he kind of knew also, right? Like, he's the whole time he's fighting back after these barriers. He's like, there wasn't a real Van Aert section of the course. You know, once or twice he went to the front in the woods, which were kind of slippery and rutted and really tried to maybe pressure Vanderpool into making a mistake, but it just wasn't that technical. I don't really know, other than like trying somehow to make the sprint faster, what he could have done differently.
Well, so wasn't the course designed by just a gentleman with the same last name as Matthew Vanderpool?
Yes, I believe they're related.
Monsieur
Father,
Audrey.
A father of some sort.
Yeah. That seems questionable to me. Granted, like, you know, he's designed lots and lots of cross courses.
Including some that Van Aert has won world titles on, so I think.
Yeah, so I mean, I've always thought that like designing a course for a rider is actually, it's not really something you can necessarily do anyway. There's so many other factors that go into mm-hmm. into winning, particularly cyclocross, right? Like, yeah, you can design a road course for somebody, but designing a cross course for a particular rider is a pretty difficult thing. But some of the things you just pointed out It was a pretty good course for Matthew Vanderpool, and it was designed by his father. It didn't have any of the things that Wout is maybe more known for.
Yeah, I mean, it turned out that way in the end, but you got to, like, the junior race that happened Sunday morning was enormous. They had 70 riders, many of whom had clearly never ridden in fields of more than, like, 30, because they just did not know what to do with a big scrum. But they really, the first lap of the junior race, if you can find it, I highly recommend watching it, just because you get a feeling for these. There were big ruts from the previous day's racing, and they were hard. Like, they had kind of firmed up overnight. And over the course of the day, and even over the course of the junior race, you can see the field go from, you know, really fighting for two and three ruts through some sections of the course to basically riding on dirt, because the sun came out, the wind came up, it really kind of steamrolled and flattened things out. And I think if we had the men's elite race in the conditions that the juniors saw, it would have really hampered Vanderpool and created more opportunities for Van Aert. I don't know that we would have seen a different outcome, but I think that's just an example of how the same exact course laid out by the same Audrey Vanderpool can result in two different races that advantage two different riders.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Like I said, it's the best rivalry in professional cycling.
For
right
sure.
Now. Like, there's nothing in any discipline, gender, there's nothing. It's just, it's incredible. And I feel like we should kind of just, well, be thankful that we're getting to witness it, basically, because like you said, it gets even better when Tom Pidcock shows up. Mm-hmm. So last thing on Cross Worlds before we move on to Alexander Kristoff's Craigslist ad, which Ian is just over here salivating to talk about. I want to talk about the drones. So,
so
this
good.
Was sort of all over Twitter, and lots of people were talking about it, and I popped out a tweet at some point where I was like, can drones follow road racing? Which, as soon as I sent it, I was like, oh yeah, of course they can. Like, I've seen them follow the Sunny King crit. I've seen them follow mm-hmm. all sorts of things. But anyway, it still returned a whole bunch of really interesting responses. And I think it sort of warrants a discussion of, like, would that be an interesting way to, I guess, kind of modernize the road racing broadcast? Or is it just kind of another, like, I don't know if you guys remember a couple years ago, 5-6 years ago, when Velon in particular first started talking about, like, putting power meter readings on TV, and everyone's like, oh, it's going to change the broadcast, it's going to grow the sport, everyone's going to be like, yay. And then it turns out no one knows what 300 watts means or 400 watts means, and it doesn't really help that much. It's not actually that, it's not even that interesting, and you also don't even know if it's really accurate, because sometimes it shows numbers where you're like, that's definitely not true. Is it that again, or is it something that could actually kind of change broadcast for the better?
As a counterpoint to how many watts things are, people are aware what looking at a bike race looks like, Caleb. So
true.
I think a drone is a way of looking at a bike race. That is a universal.
I think just the response too hints at like how beneficial this could be, how good of a thing this could be, because with the data, that was more of a, hey, look what we can do, and people like us wrote stories about that. I wrote a story about that, I remember, many, many years ago, and I still think it could
so
be cool.
Suckers, both of us.
I still think it could be cool if the data were better. But if you look at the response to the drone footage, I mean, it was immediate on Twitter. People were into it. People thought it was pretty great right away. You don't need to really know a whole lot to enjoy that.
I think that the onboard camera things that Thelon was doing is a better sort of parallel. I think that's a nice way of bringing people into the race. And drones, it gets a bit closer. It's a bit more dynamic, as long as nobody crashes one into a crowd or something or wraps it around a rider.
Many people did send me the same clip of a skier getting hit. A lot of people are sending me skiing because, including Steve Perino. So Steve Perino works for NBC. He does. He's like one of the broadcasters for the ski series for FIS stuff. He's also was on the moto for the Tour de France for NBC for a very long time. And Perino responded and said he's sort of watched this happen in skiing. It showed up for a little while, and then it took out a skier, and the FIS was like, maybe not. But it's actually recently come back, and frankly, like if they can follow skiers going 100 miles an hour, they can follow bike racing. I think that there's no question about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there that I need to unpack. I mean, clearly Steve Perino is in the pocket of Big Moto. That's his whole. He relies on the only access to the Peloton coming through him on the bike. So drones are an existential threat to this man. I do enjoy his work, though. I hope that they do not put him out of work. Because there's something...
Perino
there's something...
is one of my favorite broadcasters on the planet. So, yeah. Steve, if you're out there listening, I know you listen sometimes. Thank you for your hard work.
Yes, I also appreciate it, and I hate everything. So that is... but I think what it comes down to with... The same with on-bike cameras is that you need to get it there kind of when it's happening, and you need to get it integrated into the broadcast by people who know what is going to make for good TV and good racing. Like the drone shots we saw weren't just drone shots. Like they were continuous drone shots of a very technical section of the course where a lot of things happened that you really couldn't see from a side angle shot. You really had to follow the riders through there and watch, you know, the gap grow and shrink as they came through different sections or slid off of different ruts. And some of the, I think they may have actually had more stuff set up on Sunday. I think they had some wire shots that were just really beautifully hung over wide open sections of the mm-hmm. course. There's a shot of Sheeran Van Enroy finishing the U23 women's race kind of solo. And it's as beautiful as anything I've ever seen in cycling. You know, it's crowds, 8 people deep on either side of this totally open road with this, you know, I don't know how tall she is, 5'4", 5'5", rider just kind of cruising up, high-fiving. Like there's a church in the background, this big Sporza tent right at the finish line. It is absolutely breathtaking. And it's just, if you didn't understand that vibe of like the thrill of the crowd, of the solo finisher, no one else in the picture, I don't think a producer is going to necessarily know that that is what's going to make this such a memory, such an event, an experience to watch.
Yeah, I think you need people that are pretty deep inside the bike world to be able to select those things, right? And as a result, I feel like the first place that we'll see it done really well is probably the classics, if they do decide to try it. And they've already there's been some success with the like zip line cameras. I think it's on the Quermont was where Flanders Classic started using them first, and they just create these incredible shots. And it could be even better if it was a drone, right? Because those shots do have to be relatively high still, so they're obviously a lot lower than a helicopter, but they're still way higher than a drone could probably be. Which could basically, I mean, they were sitting off the guy's shoulders on Sunday. Those shots, like on the Paterberg, on the Quartermont, on the Arnberg at Roubaix, or the Carrefour, even where Carrefour is probably really more relevant than the Arnberg to the actual bike race, those would be pretty incredible, I think.
For me, I love the idea of being able to do what you can do with the chopper much, much closer to the riders without impacting the race. There are the finish of Strada Bianca where you're kind of coming up into that citadel. I can't count how many times I've been going back through footage and things just break up because you've got, you know, a repeater on a motorcycle, a meter off the ground, fighting through all these old buildings. And being able to have that drone just kind of come in and capture that follow up that canyon of old Italian buildings would just be incredible. The same way it was, yeah. I mean, probably more so than we saw in the woods at Hoogerheide.
Yeah, that climb up into Siena is a perfect example, right? Because, yeah, they always flip over to the helicopter shot, but it's this little narrow, almost an alley. It's a road, but it's an basically alley width, and the overhangs, and like you've got like people's washing across and stuff like that. You can't see them. It'd be amazing to have a drone.
I think the Arenberg.
I hope same. It comes to yeah. Arenberg would be so amazing. Tight. I mean, like if you've never been to the Arenberg, the atmosphere there is you can't really capture it on a moto even. Because the motos have to sort of back off a fair ways or be well in front of the race. They have to stay a little ways away. You definitely can't capture it in a helicopter. It would be pretty amazing to run a drone through there. So anyway, I don't want to spend too much time on drones other than it was really well done throughout the entire weekend at Worlds. And I hope they figure out areas that they can use these things going forward in road racing because, yeah, it would just... We know that really good visuals help tell the story, and telling the story does genuinely help grow the sport. So from that perspective, I mean, maybe it's not going to change the world for cycling, but every little bit helps, right? And we all want bike racing to grow. So I hope that happens.
I just want to go on record here. You won't often hear this from me, but well done, UCI.
Fair.
We're gonna clip that little bit of audio. We're gonna play it over and over and over again.
Got your press pass back.
Just got your press pass back. All right, I want to move on a little bit. So I've had a couple people send me messages over the last couple weeks after Ian's last appearance on the podcast, and basically say that they would like a segment where Ian just talks about things that are in his brain. And so
this is terrifying.
And so that's, I mean, we don't have a name for this segment. If anyone's got a great idea for a name, you know, hit me up on the social medias here. We'll drop this in at some point, but there are two things on today's run sheet that I think Ian will really actually three, but two that are not Fanta, that I think you'll really tap into here, Ian. So the first is the ongoing legend of Patrick Lefebvre's pillows. Can cool. you please explain to the listeners what I'm talking about?
Okay, so the team that is now Subal Quickstep for many years has had a sponsorship arrangement with a company called Latex Co. And the form that sponsorship takes is that Latex Co. provide the team with latex pillows, and then the team provide Latex Co. with a pillow fight. So every single year, good. Around this time, there's a photo shoot that comes out, the traditional pillow fight photo shoot, and it may be my favorite cycling tradition, because it's just a bunch of boys in Lycra lying around on top of each other, shot from above. And I'm sure there are
not
people.
Always. Well, not always.
No. Sometimes it's a side angle and they're having a little snuggle or whatever.
Yeah, they'll be like leaning on each other, sleeping, head on shoulder, all lined up.
And those are, I think the thing that's fun about the Latex Co. photo shoot is that it veers between like cozy, cuddly cycling team and just outright violence. And this year we get the latter. So this year we have Tim de Klerk in one corner, sort of punched away from the action. We have Florian Seneschal actually punching Casper Asgreen in the face. We've got another guy who I couldn't identify. I asked Kaylee this before we recorded, because there's a man who I'm sure...
Top left. Oh, I don't know who that is.
So I described him as like an Elon Musk looking guy with like... veins popping across his forehead, because he is just going hard.
He's making a weird face, which I feel like, I mean, certainly we know who this is, but he's making a weird enough face that I can't actually tell you with any certainty.
Yeah, no, it's bizarre. But I think when we start unpacking the pillow fight, there's a number of things that I want to hone in on. One of which is that Florian Seneschal in this photo shoot has two pillows. Some of them have none, so he's just going to town. he's also like very close to just kicking Tim de Klerk. There's leaks all over the place. It's a real mess. And the other thing is that I'm not sure if anyone's ever used a latex pillow or is familiar with the art of the latex pillow, but they're not like the soft, fluffy things that you would imagine in some stereotypical pillow fight. They're quite weighty.
No goose down here. No goose down.
No. It's like someone's going to end up with bruises. And I think that this is something that is uniquely possible during the off season, where it doesn't matter if somebody just breaks a nose. That's fine in the pursuit of latex pillow marketing. So that's the, yeah, I mean, it's a wrong-headed decision from Latex Co. because it's so predictable that when you get a bunch of elite sports people together and ask them to have a pillow fight, it's going to turn extremely competitive. And we've seen this year after year. If it's not carefully stage directed, that you're like, okay, now Paolo Bettini, have a cuddle with Tom Bonin. If you're not doing that, then someone's going to get more.
Is there a use case for latex pillows?
Oh, like, I think beyond might be being like pillows? Cooler on your head.
Huh. Have to contact Latex Co.
More durable?
I mean, it's probably an allergen thing. Is it an allergen thing? Like, yeah, if but you...
I would you also have say a latex that many people allergy. Are allergic to getting beaten in the face with a pillow.
I just like that they do this every single year, and they have, like, all the way back, like you said, like, to the because Quicksteps have been around a very long time, but I'm talking, like, you know, Boonen era. There's the great one with everyone sleeping on Levi Leipheimer. That's a fun one. That's back from, that's got to be 10-plus years ago now, right? There's the one with, must have been like 2012, 2013, where everyone's got a pillow except Tom Boonen, who's just boxing, who's just got his fists up. Anyway, if you go ahead and Google Quick Step Pillow Fight, you're going to find all sorts of fantastic options through the years. There's many, many to enjoy. And if it's your thing, you know, like someone, I tweeted this photo out earlier and someone just responded, yum. So maybe some people really like this sort of...
Yeah, honestly, I think that there's a small sort of slice of this pie, which is that find this stirring at some sort of deep level. Like there's a primal sort of, in the loins, if you were inclined to that sort of thing, and no judgment if you are. But I would say that this year's offering is a particularly strong one, if only because of Casper Asgreen getting punched in the face.
It's highly enjoyable. And once again, we are sad we don't have a website yet. People keep asking. We're working on it. They take a while to build.
I also just briefly derail this and say that one thing, final thought on the pillow fight that I'll add is that Quickstep are weirdly cagey about it, because at several points I've sent emails asking for historical pillow fight pictures just for my records, and nothing's asked. And they have been cagey. They've not responded. They are keeping this locked down, and I think it's time to blow it up.
But I don't know, like, the fact that, so they posted it today on Instagram. They're kind of in on the joke now. Right, because previously, so originally, we found these because Tim DeWalla, who's a photographer, kind of ran his own agency for a while, and then I think sold that to Getty. So all his images are now on Getty. Tim was the photographer for Quickstep for a very long time, and we had access to Tim's library. And one day, like 6-7 years ago, we were just cruising through this library and found these photos just out of nowhere that I don't think we're ever supposed to see the light of day. And it kind of stayed that way for quite a while, where, like, they became known kind of within the bike media world that these were funny and they existed, and they'd pop up every once in a while. Like Cycling Weekly would put a story up, you know, us at Velo News back in the day, we'd put a story up. And it's only been the last, like, 18 months, 2 years that they've fully embraced these images, because why else would they put it on Instagram? They weren't doing that 5 years ago.
No, but they also have pictures of the boys drinking their non-alcoholic beers and whatever, and that's fine. And I think at a certain level that is just, they promise to Latex Co. that they will have X number of social media impressions, so quick, we better get a picture up of Casper Asgreen getting nailed. So I'm sure that there's some And I think actually, as you look through the season, I did a bit of a deep dive into their non-alcoholic beer sponsor a few years ago, because of course, and you can see that there's a point in the season where they're like, oh, quick, we need to get some non-alcoholic beer appreciation. And then there's just a flurry of posts whilst their social media person just ticks a key deliverable. And then it's just back to racing shots. It's madness.
I'm going to text. We're gonna ask Phil about this. Phil is the press officer over at Quickstep. Lovely, lovely human being. Played cricket with him at the Tour de France last year. In fact, let's find out. We're gonna get the real story here. I know that he has rebuffed you previously,
so many
Ian,
times.
But now that we've played cricket, I feel like maybe we bonded a little bit, and he's gonna give us a real.
You're
answer.
Also helping Quickstep secure sponsors because you are adding to the awareness of Latex Co. by talking about it. I mean, this is what they want.
Yeah.
I think
this is a media impression.
I think
exactly
it is media impressions, but I also think that they're probably looking for things like, man, that's a good pillow to sleep on. Not, man, that would hurt if you got hit in the nose.
But the thing is, they've got to be in on the joke, right?
I think so.
Like, this is a bunch of very fit men with shaved legs and tight clothing romping around in bedding. Like, there's just a smirking underlying sexual tension here that
I'm telling you, I don't think they were 6 years ago. Like, at least not publicly, but I think they are now. I think they're now they've stepped into the pillow fight world.
If you look back at the year that Cav is in one of these pillow fight teams, you will see a man who is having no fun whatsoever.
That syncs with previous Cav stories I've heard. So I wonder if Astana could have a pillow fight, what that would be like.
Ooh. Well, they do rap videos, so maybe that's more his speed.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, every team needs their thing, right? And I look forward to next year's. This year's was good. It was, you know, from just a pure aesthetic perspective, it was a nicely framed image. There's limbs. You can't even really tell what limbs belong to whom. And it's nicely lit. And I thought it was a superb example of the genre this year, I think.
It was very good. And I would also like to have a chat to the photographer and just find out the specifics of how long he was up on a gantry hovering over a quartet of men having a pillow.
Well, soon they're going to replace him
with
a drone.
Beal.
So you better talk to him now.
It's Wout Beal these days. So Tim DeWall is not doing it anymore. So we need to just chat with Wout about how that one went down. Because I bet he's got a sense of humor. I bet he plays ball. Anyway, we've now spent as much time on pillows as we did on Crossworlds.
That's what
so
the people want.
The way it should be.
We've got a lot to talk about today.
The cyclocross disrespect.
I'm a little bit concerned even without a text segment, we're going to run out of time. So a couple quick hits here. Esteban Chavez won the Colombian national title. You may have seen some images or video from this, him crying on the podium. Nairo Quintana was third. He was also crying on the podium for probably different reasons. Anyway, just wanted to mention this because Esteban Chavez is, I don't know, one of the nicest people in all of pro cycling. He's had a rough go of it the last couple of years, and you can see how much it meant to him to win this title. He had some great quotes that came out. I was just reading a Cy Vacher piece over at Velo News with some of those. Any thoughts on Chavez? Is he, like, going to come back? He's been very, very, very quiet for 2 years, and it's bumming me out.
I think one thing with Chavez that I feel like kind of gets overlooked a little bit is that he won in Lombardia. He's Colombia's first ever Monument Classic winner, and because...
I mean,
he was
in 2016. It's been a while.
Sure,
Bane.
Sure.
Come on,
it's been a little while. But he was kind of hyped up as this GC talent, and for obvious reasons, because he was a GC talent when he was pretty young still, and finished as highly as second in a Grand Tour. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, if he were to retire tomorrow with a monument victory and 5 career Grand Tour stage wins to go with the other things he did, like second overall at the Giro, it's a heck of a good career as is. As opposed to, I think people have this idea that he's sort of a guy who maybe didn't fulfill his potential. And I just think Joaquin Rodriguez had a pretty similar slate of results. And I just want Chavez to get some of his due. That's all.
Yeah, there's a lot of riders I think who fall into this category where it's like, well, you know, you didn't win a Grand Tour, and it's like there's other races out there that are really good, like Lombardia, that like I don't understand the vacuum that watching racing for 3 weeks just pulls all the oxygen away from these other things. I think there are so many riders, Rodriguez included, who maybe could have been better if they'd really focused on hilly one days versus Grand Tours.
Maybe that's where he should go. I mean, he's other than Lombardia, he's probably found most of his success at the Giro, right? A bunch of stage wins, podium. Was leading until the second rest day. I'm trying to remember what year it was now. They all run together for me. Anyway, he's found a fair amount of success in Italy, and I wonder if he seems to find success in Italy, Lombardia included. I wonder if a little bit more attention on that type of race, because the Italian races, sort of like full stop, have a type, right? Giro, Lombardia, Strade Bianche, they all have a type, which is that the roads are narrow, the roads are bad, the roads are steep, the roads are unpredictable, and that seems to be good, apparently, for Esteban Chavez, which would also line up with, I've ridden in Colombia, kind of similar in a lot of ways. Makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. So I wonder if pivoting that direction would be better for him. Because he's one of those riders that I think like everybody wants to see do well. I mean, I still remember when he's coming back from Epstein Barr, and it was the Giro, and he won a stage, and the entire peloton came to say congratulations. I don't think I've ever seen a response like that at a finish line, where everybody is happy for the guy that just won. I just hope that he can sort of figure it out and get back to that level.
He also, I think, if you just look at his recent career, it's not like he completely disappeared from the top of a leaderboard. He was in the top 10 quite a bunch of the past year and a half, and in stage races, and I think that speaks to the fact that he's still got plenty of talent. You need everything to go your way, and you need to be really, really, really good to win a Grand Tour. But I think you can win a 1 week or a 1 day race with a little bit more luck and kind of things going your way. So hopefully that can happen for him, and I think it can. If, like I said, some things go your way, you can win a 1 day race, and that doesn't usually happen so much for a Grand Tour, where you need things to go your way every day for 21 days.
There's another rider that I want to talk about who, he's a bit of a return this week. Rui Costa won bike race over the weekend. Dane, let's keep this one brief, but what did Rui do? I mean, this is a former world champion who, again, was basically completely anonymous for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I'd say that Rui was maybe even more anonymous in the past few years. And he's started out this year hot. He won the Trofeo Calvia, and then he went and won the Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana with the final stage win and the GC win for Intermarché, which is his new team after he spent 6 years... I was going to say 6 years wandering the desert at UAE, but that's like all two on the nose, right? Okay. He didn't do much at UAE after his world's win. He was like a perennial favorite to win the Tour de Suisse, and then he just kind of went quiet. But yeah, he won a Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana over the past few days, and that was quite a start list, by the way. That's a race that, although it's pretty new, has drawn some really big names. So good for Rui Costa, and it's really good for Intermarché, a team that is now a World Tour squad and needs wins like this.
The spring. They're looking really good. There.
Well, speaking of Valenciana, there was another name that kind of caught my eye that weekend, and clearly I wasn't alone, because a good friend of the podcast, Chris Marshall Bell, who's a freelancer for Cycling Tips and Cycling Weekly and Velo News and a whole bunch of others. Brit living down in Spain, he caught up with Thomas Gloge, who is a 21-year-old Brit who impressed at Valenciana. He was really up there with some of the best stage racers and one-day racers in the world, and he's really green. He has basically come out of nowhere to show up at the pointy end of these races. So Chris caught up with Thomas, and I caught up with Chris earlier today for a segment that we are going to be calling Talent Spotting. Let's hear about Thomas Gloge.
Hello.
Chris Marshall Bell, how are you today?
I'm very good, Billy Fritz. How are you?
I'm excellent. I texted you with why we're calling. We're doing a little segment on, well, I guess up and comers is basically the gist of it. And you wrote a great story for Cycling Weekly this week. I think actually this morning it posted, at least my time, about Thomas Gloag and Valenciana. And I wanted to just pick your brain about this young man.
So, of course,
what attracted you to this story? I guess, I mean, was it just the fact that he got second?
No. So I first spoke with Thomas about maybe 3 or 4 months ago. And I was struck by not only how polite and grateful and just happy and cheery as a human being that he was, but how raw and green he is as a cyclist. He was very eager to get the point across that he knows basically nothing, and his cycling education and his cycling background is quite minimal. That's not to say that what he did at Trinity was counting for nothing. It's more to say that he's never really had a coaching upbringing where he knows even his FTP. He didn't even know 3 years ago that he had to eat sugar constantly. He admitted that he would go 3-hour rides without eating anything, without even drinking anything. And he's almost like this blank canvas. And Jumbo have just picked him up. They've clearly seen his power numbers and realized that he's got a lot of potential. And yeah, he's got this blank canvas and he's just a complete project who could go one way or a different way or a obscure way. So yeah, he's just a really exciting young individual, but more than anything, he's just a really happy young guy. And I think we all like happy people, no?
I think you in particular are attracted to that type.
I am indeed.
I think so. Can you tell me a little bit about where he comes from? I mean, how is he so good? And yet, I guess, I mean, it's not late because he's not old, but like, never sort of discovered early in the junior ranks or anything like that. How did that work?
Well, he is 21, Kaylee, and in the era of cycling, he is an old man. He is old.
That's true.
So he raced for his club team, which was VC Londres, which is in the south of London. And people might recognize that name for bringing through Fred Wright, Ethan Hayter, Leo Hayter, and lots of other young riders as well in the past 10, 15 years. But he wasn't picked up until he was 19 by Trinity, which was essentially the offshoot of the old Wiggins team. And people might remember that they had Tom Pidcock as well. And whilst he was at Trinity, he progressed quite strongly. He won a stage of the Ronde d'Isard in 2021. And then last season, he won a stage of L'Avenir, which is obviously nicknamed the Tour of the Future. He did have a few... He was on a few training camps with Ineos, but he decided to go to Jumbo. No one actually knows why. When I've asked him about that, he didn't really go into depth. But he clearly wanted to do something a little bit differently. And I think within that answer explains a lot about Thomas in that he's a very intelligent young kid and he's not afraid to try different things. I know when I last spoke to him as well before this race, he was explaining that he's now doing a maths course at an open university. So he's very intelligent, he's very smart, and he's very keen to go his own way. As for why he wasn't picked up before, I just think the main answer to that is he didn't really have any results as a junior. He's just developed massively in the last 2 years. But yeah, Jumbo certainly do seem to have a real good find on their hands.
Where do you see him fitting in the short term and long term? I mean, you spoke with his coach. I'm assuming you spoke with some of the folks at Jumbo. What do they think about him?
Short answer is no one knows. And no one knows because, like I mentioned before, he's a complete blank canvas. I actually asked him this weekend if he prefers short climbs or long climbs. And he adopted a bit of a confused look and went, well, I don't know, because he literally does not know. I was also taking a look at his results this morning, and he's only ever ridden one individual time trial. So it's hard to say that he's going to develop into a GC rider, or is he going to be a climber? It's really hard to say. I think in the short term, Jumbo will be giving him a lot of stage racing opportunities. I don't expect any jump to it, maybe not even for the first 2 years. He's very similar to Tobias Foss and Jonas Vingegaard, in the sense that when they arrived at Jumbo, they were quite untested. They didn't really have a cycling pedigree, and now they've developed into these superstars that they are. So I think if we were to take Vingegaard's example, he didn't ride a Grand Tour until the end of his second year. So that's probably the similar timeline that we can expect with Globe. But yeah, looking forward, it's a work in progress, and I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised whatever path he goes down.
Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly a huge engine, and I just looked up his stats. Maybe you can confirm these because you've actually stood in front of him, and I don't always believe what I see on the internet here. Sort of average height, like 5'10", and like 60 kilos, is that about right? So pretty sort of standard kind of GC rider build.
Yeah, I mean, he's not an imposing figure. He doesn't stand over you. Not that I'm particularly small, but but yeah, no, yeah, I would say about 5'10" and 60 to 62 kilo. So he's sort of got the perfect figure for a GC rider.
What year is he going to win the Tour de France?
I think, well, if Vingegaard won when he was 25, he's going to follow the same path. I should say that Thomas Globe should be winning the Tour de France in 2027. So no pressure, Tom.
Perfect. We'll just pull that little clip out and play it back when it comes to 2027. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the pod today. I really, really appreciate it. If you want to hear more or read more about Thomas Gloag, go check out Chris Marshall Bell's piece over in Cycling Weekly. Thanks, man.
Thank you. See you soon.
America Watch.
Yes.
How are they doing?
Yes, America Watch. Nielsen Palace has had a great week and a half. Won the Grand Prix Cycliste de Marseille, La Marseillaise. I don't know why you need to have a Grand Prix de Marseille, La Marseillaise. But anyway, he won. That's a one-day race. Good for him. He's, by the way, a guy who has already won a World Tour one day, and now he's kind of backing it up. He won the Japan Cup at the end of last year, just won that race a few days ago, and then he followed that up with the GC win at the Étoile de Bessèges, which, again, another early-season race that draws quite a few big names. Poor Matthias Skelmos of Trek Segafredo was leading into the final stage, which was a time trial. And Nielsen Palace, not really known as... you know, the world's greatest time trialist, but a time trialing talent for sure, managed to overhaul him and won the GC by 1 second. So sorry, Matthias Skelmos. And congratulations, Nielsen Palace. That's his first GC win. And I think Palace has had a heck of a 2 years or so. And EF has to be really happy that they managed to grab him, pick him up after his 2 year stint at Jumbo, a team that I think has done a pretty good job of developing talents. But the fact that EF was able to pick up Nielsen Palace and he's been one of their winninger riders recently, they got to be happy with that.
Well, speaking of... No, I have no segue here. I have no way to segue.
The segue is
from
like
Nielsen
Ian
Palace.
Is here.
Speaking...
So,
you were speaking about Intermarché before.
Well, Intermarché was mentioned at some point in this podcast. And so therefore, speaking of Intermarché, let's talk about Alexander Kristoff. Can we call him the Stavanger Stallion, or is that IP?
I hope it's not IP. I mean, I use it in my daily life.
I think we're good.
Surely,
I think it's fair use. I'm sure it's fair use. Anyway, the Stavanger
I'm also pleased to note that Intermarché's social media refers to him as hashtag Stavanger Stallion.
On it. Oh, wow.
So I'm glad that it's crossed over. So, no, it's their intellectual property now. So, yeah, I'm doing good about this.
So this very important news story came across your desk, Ian, because these are your desk is the one that they usually come across, and it turns out that he sold a bike.
Selling.
Tell me what happened.
Selling. He
selling.
Hasn't sold
he's,
it yet. No, he's desperately
no
hunting for a buyer.
It. No one's bought it. Well, he's got to make those Lambo payments. That's
true. Yeah. Yeah. So Alexander Kristoff is selling his bike on Finn.no, which for Australian listeners is like a Gumtree. For American listeners, it's a Craigslist. It's basically the leading online sales platform in Norway, but it's not glitz and glam. It's like a map with this is the approximate area that this bike might be in, and a user written description of that bike, which means that we have unvarnished thoughts from the Sarangan Stallion about his cube. I'd just like to put out there that for a man who does not strike me as particularly characterful, he's quite a stoic, sensible man. He knows his way around the blur function of his camera on his iPhone. He took some quite artful pictures. It doesn't say
we got portrait mode.
Yeah, yep. It doesn't say that he his name isn't on the ad anywhere, but we know that it's his bike because it has an Alexander Kristoff sticker on it, and the ad is written in first person, and includes such gems as Rask Sickle, Som Er Mir Pengene, a fast bike that is a lot for the money, and he has been veldig fornøyd, very happy with the cube. So this this bike is 6 months soiled under Kristoff. It's a
soiled.
Lightly soiled by Alexander Kristoff. It's just great to see. He mentions as a man who is the most 56
centimeter. Wait, can you send me the link for it?
I will send you the link, absolutely.
Send it right now. I want to look at this. Yeah.
He's quite a big man. He's 182 centimeters, he notes in his own ad. And that's a 56 centimeter sized man. And he tries to sell the bicycle buyers of Stavanger on the fact that at a 54 centimeter bike would probably be the upper limit for somebody that is 182 centimeters. So he's quite honest about that. Look, it's just good gear. He gets rid of his bike computer. There's a whole big deal. His pedals, all of that comes with it, and you get to go to his lavish family home on a hill just behind my in-law's house, which is how I know so much about it and how I've ridden past it multiple times. And strangely enough, I know that this picture was taken on the pathway next to his dedicated Lamborghini garage because I've ridden past his house several times. So that's your Stavanger Stallion update from today.
So my analysis of this listing is that, unfortunately, I mean, it's possible this bike was raced, but this looks like a training bike.
It says, Taylor, do you not see that? Yeah. It's the first
I don't
first
speak
line.
Norwegian.
It says, min training sickle.
Oh, well, so, it's a con game. When on. I did Google, when I did Google Translate, it just says my exercise bike, which that's
oh,
all bikes. Like, all bikes are exercise. Anyway, it's his training bike. It's got Altegra on it.
Dura-Ace crankset. Yeah.
Dura-Ace crankset. Power meter. Got the power meter.
Still
definitely
has the Alexander Kristoff sticker.
Not quite slammed stem, but quite close, and looks like about a 130.
That's
on
an
there.
Enormous
so you,
stem.
You're going to want to have, yeah, you're going to want to be stretched out if you're going to jump on the Stallion's steed.
So,
but it looks pretty good. Looks
he rides for No X now, so he I don't think he's contracted to say nice things about his bike. So he must be telling the truth. It must be a great bike for the value.
And interestingly, yeah. when he left UAE, I don't know if he was like totally hanging shit on Colnago, but he was pretty complimentary of Cube in comparison to previous bikes he'd been riding. So Uno X are on a company called Dare, which I haven't heard very much about, so I don't know if they're good bikes, and I don't know if in a couple of years when Alexander Kristoff retires to the great luxury family home in the sky, whether he will be saying equally complimentary things about the Dare bikes when he puts them on Finn.no. But, you know, he's got good stuff to say about the cube, and I think that's very comforting for somebody with 55,000 Norwegian kroner burning a hole in their pocket.
How much is that? How much is 55,000 Norwegian kroner?
Oh.
It's like 5,000 US. Yeah.
It's a decent price.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good bike that has been ridden around on some very, very salty, gritty roads. Next to a fjord.
It looks like it's in great shape.
He's cleaned it, the photos. You can see that it's recently cleaned. There's still water on it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and the sticker is still on there. And that's kind of the cool part. Like, someone could actually buy this bike and ride it around with Alexander Kristoff stickers on it.
I also have another Alexander Kristoff Finn.no related story. thanks to a listener, Cora Chisentak. he tells me that Alexander Kristoff has form in selling bikes on Finn.no and recently tried to get rid of his 2018 Champs-Élysées winning bike until he found some space for it, probably on the wall of his Lamborghini garage. So he withdrew the ad, but he's given it a go before.
Why? Why would you sell that bike? That's sad.
I mean, if you have watched the numerous videos where Alexander Kristoff invites a film crew into his house to film him eating sushi and all those kind of things, which I have, you'll know that there are lots of bikes on the wall, lots of jerseys. He's a man that we don't think about as one of the greatest cyclists, but there was a period when he was riding for Katusha where he was just winning everything. So I think he's probably got enough memorabilia. I'm glad that he decided to hang on to that bike, but I have no qualms with him getting rid of his Ultegra equipped training bike from last year.
Yeah, no, me too. If there's anybody out there who buys this bike, please let us know. We would love a review.
He seems fastidious. I'm sure it's been immaculately taken care of.
He's probably got a good mechanic, I would imagine. Well, the last thing on our run sheet today, Ian, it just says something about sarsaparilla. So I don't really know what that means. It turns out this might be about Fanta instead. Explain.
Okay, so over recent editions of this podcast, we've had a drink corner, which started with me expressing some misgivings about Fanta, which some wrong people were wrong about, but I was correct. Anyway, a listener has sent through a picture of an Australian item, a Mentos Fanta, a Fanta flavored Mentos. I don't know if you have Mentos in the land of the free.
Oh, yes.
If you put those in a carbonated drink, don't they explode?
Some galaxy brain at Fanta or at Mentos has decided that this is a combo that people want. But I don't see a way that that doesn't end up just frothing around in your gut until you're just spouting at both ends. So that's my sort of Fanta moment for this week. Kaylee last week was promoting an off-brand Aperol Spritz, like a flat Aperol Spritz called La Bicicleta.
I think it's older than the Aperol Spritz, so you take that back.
So the Aperol Spritz is when somebody came in and just decided to give it a funky fresh remix.
Yeah, just add some bubbles, basically.
Let's add some bubbles. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. So this week for Drinks Corner, I was going to talk about sarsaparilla, but upon looking at Wikipedia, I've discovered that I'm too scared to talk about sarsaparilla because it means different things to different people. And there's some Asian sarsaparillas, there's some Central American sarsaparillas, and the Australian sarsaparilla, which I thought I knew and loved, by Bundaberg, is unlike either of those. So I am going to withdraw this segment and just say that I've been enjoying ginger beer.
I'm just reading on Wikipedia that Australian sarsaparilla has a flavor different from that of American root beer, which is what we tend to associate. Well, what does it taste like is what I wonder.
It tastes like Bundaberg sarsaparilla.
I mean, yeah, I knew you were going to say that. I don't know why.
You just
I
need
asked.
To wrap your mouth around one of those and you'll understand.
I don't know why I asked that question. I knew that was coming.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever had sarsaparilla. I've had root beer for sure, but no.
Here you get like Jamaican, which basically tastes like root beer, or similar. It's not the same, but it's similar.
Is Sioux City sarsaparilla Jamaican sarsaparilla? Because that would be a complete clash of names.
It's a line of soft drinks manufactured and marketed by White Rock Beverages, Cosmo. I know this because I had just clicked on the Sioux City soft drink Wikipedia page when you asked that question.
I mean, it's name-dropped in the Big Lebowski. It has to be good, right?
That's also mentioned, by the way, in the Wikipedia page. Good on whoever did this edit for the Wikipedia page.
And to bring all of this full circle, if you're in Cambodia, the sarsaparilla there is sold under the Fanta brand.
Well, how about that?
Perfect. How perfect.
I imagine that's a large segment of our listenership, so shout out to the Cambodian sarsaparilla drinkers.
I'll do a quick deep dive on the geography of our listenership. Needless to say, if you love a good sarsaparilla, why don't you tell us why your country's sarsaparilla is best? We'd love to hear from
and
you.
And if you live in Cambodia and buy Alexander Kristoff's bike, you're definitely getting on the podcast. Just if you really want to be on the show, just keep that in mind.
100% chance. All right. We have reached our hour, gentlemen. It was highly enjoyable. I really appreciate you coming on, Cosmo.
Happy
and
to be here.
Worlds with us and everything else. You're going to be back. You're going to be back. So that's a bit of a teaser, I guess. Dane, thanks for joining.
Thank you, Kelly.
And Ian, thank you for popping on once again today.
Thank you.
Reminder to everybody out there that you should go make sure you listen to this week's Geek Warning. It'll be in this channel. It'll also be in its own channel if you want to go look for it there. Maybe I shouldn't say that because I'm not actually sure iTunes has approved it yet. But anyway, it'll be there soon. If you love tech shows, definitely give that one a listen. And please do share it, just like the show you're listening to right now. We're basically entirely reliant on word of mouth because we have no marketing budget. So if you could just share it with all the people that you know and love, then we'd really appreciate it. A ton of you reposted my little Instagram last time. I very much appreciate that. So, I don't know. Do that again. That was great. Worked really well. All right. That's it from us here at the Placeholders. We'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
See you.